national God. He is the God of the universe who patiently bore with a Jewish people who really didn't want him. That's one of the amazing things. He hung on to them, pursued them, wooed them, kept after them, cried, wept, begged, pled, stretched out his arms 14 centuries, and kept hold of them until he could bring forth Earth's number one son, send him, give his life. The whole thing amazes me that we're outsiders. He has allowed us to be a part of his plan. And we were a part of his original plan. But it amazes me. Please don't make the mistake of thinking that God was a European or an American or a non-Jew. Of course, he's not any of those. He's not a Jew either. But don't make the mistake of seeing the distinction between who you are. Is there any Jewish background or Jewish Christian here today? Well, that's our loss. We're added to the root. Don't forget that. And don't just assume. It'll broaden your perspective if you'll make sure that you understand that we are very blessed to have been grafted into this root. Okay, there's another person here that I'd like to mention before I begin. That's my son-in-law, Mark Phillips. He asked that I not mention him in context of the other two men last night, and so I... He's one of the finest things that's happened to this church, and I know you're aware of that. He's one of the finest things that's happened to me and my family. We love him dearly. And he's got three precious children that are our grandchildren. We share them with Marvin, his dad. I grudgingly let him mooch around on Keller and the girls. But it's wonderful to have... You know, I think I couldn't stand it if my daughters had married someone that was abusive or that didn't love the Lord. And I've always told them and other young people, marry somebody that loves God more than loves you. That's our only safeguard. The only way you can work, it'll work. Well, last night we did some discussing. Today we'll focus and sharpen the focus a bit and look more directly and specifically at us. We're going to talk this morning about discerning ourselves. Discerning ourselves. It's easy enough to see other people and get the speck out of their eye. Jesus knew that, and that's why he talked about this log being in our eye and our not knowing it. Surprise, surprise. Here's this 4x4 jutting out of our eye, and we couldn't even see it. And this morning, I don't want to be critical. I hope to be objective, and so that we can get a focus on who we are and why we're that way, and the strengths and the weaknesses. We'll not probably get into the strengths and weaknesses as such, but just try to decide or to discern who we are. Last night, we made the observation that each legitimate restoration movement was born or spawned either by internal vacuums and deficits or external conditions and circumstances. And we gave the benefit of the doubt and assumed that each of these people who were responsible for these movements, and usually they had a leader, that they did this in all sincerity. I have no way on earth of impugning their motives any more than they have of mine. We all simply have to grant one another that grace that this was done out of a sense of earnestness and sincerity and desire to please God. And every last one of us is elliptical. We're all out of balance. You've never met a well-balanced person. There's not a well-balanced person in this audience. That's right. You've never heard a well-balanced speaker. And you know that's true. We're all out of balance. The only balanced thing on earth that you'll ever know is God. And Jesus Christ, we believe, is the embodiment of God. He's the only well-balanced person we know. And these movements, begun in sincerity, and we notice legitimately, they are those groups that hold to the deity of Christ and the truthfulness of the Word of God, and that their efforts were genuine. That, though all of those pluses, that they either immediately or eventually isolated a particular truth or awareness. They saw it. They grabbed it. They put a halo around it. They isolated it, and it eventually insulated them from what was around them, and it became that from which they drew their identity. Now, are we all comfortable with that premise? That's what we worked off of last night. Are we all comfortable with that? And what it does, it reduces us to a common level. And there's so much good in the best of us and so much bad in the worst of us that it ill behooves any of us to speak ill of the best of the rest of us. I think that's it, or almost it. I think I got it back around. There's so much good in the worst of us and so much bad in the best of us that it ill behooves any of us to speak ill of the rest of us. I never was a poet, and but that, you get the idea. It reduces us to a common level, and that's not bad, because we learned last night, I think, that elitism is not essential to salvation. In fact, it's a very great jeopardy. You're in jeopardy. There was a man who majored in elitism, and who was the man? In the New Testament, Jesus told a story about him. Oh, mercy, no. I don't know who said it. Not Paul. He majored in elitism. He stood before, the Pharisees said, God, I'm glad I'm not like these other people. Yeah, that was his basic premise with which he stood before God. He was glad he was not like other people. And Jesus just sent him home condemned. So elitism is not essential. Now, our movement is no different in this respect. There were external and internal conditions that spawned our movement. And we're not going to spend a lot of time in this just by way of introduction. Our movement, and I'm referring to that as the Restoration Movement of America. It had its roots back in Europe, yes. But it came at a time when in the religious world there was much confusion and division. And I'm referring to that in a sense as the externals. But there was a lot of division. The Reformation had produced, it had released them from the shackles of Roman Catholicism and authoritarianism, and it was like a blunderbuss. It just blew, and it was like a scattergun. It just created all manner of division, all manner of confusion, all manner of individual thinking, all manner of interpretations. And of course, the Roman Church knew that, and that's why they knew there had to be an official sanctioned and endorsed interpretation in order to maintain this uniformity. Even that didn't work. There's a lot of division in the Roman Church. But anyway, that's some of the external, circumstances. Ceremony and ritual had become cluttered and unclear. It needed simplification. It needed clarification. Baptism, the Lord's Supper, organization. These external rituals and rites and forms needed reexamining. There was enough incrustation on the things that were seen visibly by the world. There was enough there to cloud the issue, really. And those who reexamined the Roman practices, God bless them, they needed reexamining. It needed cleaning out. And I don't regret one whit any cleaning that Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and those men did. God knows it needed cleaning. And I think he cleaned house. And I just don't regret it at all. I know it caused a lot of differentiation. I know it caused a lot of diversity. It caused a lot of confusion. And out of that confusion, there came an awareness that there needs to be a simplification. And out of the division that existed, there needed to be a movement that wanted to bring about unity. Those were some of what I'm calling the externals. There were some internal personalities. There were some internal factors in the main leaders of all of those movements. In our own movement, there were some internal personalities. The two that stand out were Campbell and Stone. As different as daylight and dark, Stone was a more laid-back person. He was a more spirit-led person. He was a more emotional person. He was a less critical. He was the let it slide Clyde of this duo. Campbell was the here comes the judge. And when he gets right down to it, he was very analytical. He was a brilliant man, intelligent. His intellect was, I don't even understand it. I'm not talking about understanding the workings of it. I don't understand the capacity, the amount of it. anybody that would have the absolute gall and brilliance to stand up in the Senate or the House, wherever it was, as a representative from Virginia, I think, and reply to somebody's criticism in Greek. Stood up and quoted a long thing in Greek. That blows my mind. But anyway, the thing about our movement is that we took after Campbell's personality. We didn't take after Stone. That's one of the things that helped determine who we are. He had the stronger personality, and we took upon ourselves the nature of Alexander Campbell, his emotional, intellectual, that's who we are. That's why we've spent all these years, you know, doing all this dividing and splitting, not of necessarily in division, but I'm talking about discerning all the tenses of verbs and all that stuff. He was, you know, he could do that. And here's the thing that amazes me. We have attracted that kind of people over the years. And that's what the world, that's what happens. When movements form and their personalities begin to become obvious, people who are geared like that are attracted to that kind of a movement. And I don't say that that explains totally the growth of movements, but there's a whole lot to be said about the nature of human beings to be attracted to that which they can understand and which creates vibrations in them. And emotional people are attracted to emotional movement. Intellectually oriented people are attracted to intellectually oriented movement. Type A, you know, here we go. And yet that breaks down too. In the Boston movement, which was a very type A oriented movement, they attracted people who were the very opposite, because the people who were the opposite looked to that kind of people to order their lives for them. So it attracted both kinds of people. But anyway, that'll break down eventually. But I'm saying that part of who we are is due to the internal that existed, part of it to the external circumstances that existed around us. Then there was an overarching thing that was in favor of our movement at the time in which it had such phenomenal growth, and that was the restorationist mindset of America itself. And in the book Discovering Our Roots, he discusses that. And in your billfold, you'll have dollar bills that have the seal of America, the seal on it. It's this big pyramid with the eye at the top and all. He described that. On your dollar bill, you'll see a restorationist logo that was designed to state that America was the embodiment of restorationism. We were the restoration nation. We were the nation with whom God, in second hand, had made this covenant with England. We were the ones who were going to be the fulfillment of it. It was a great time. Eden had been rediscovered. We had a new start. All of this, read about it. You're going to have a copy of it in just a few minutes. I'll show you how. But this was part of who we are. This is a part of why we had such phenomenal growth in those earlier years. There was this burning awareness and this desire on the part of all Americans. It was a pioneer passion. It was an American theme, an American dream, to be a part of a restoration. And so when we came with this fresh appeal toward restoration in terms of religion, it was just like putting honeys with bees. Bees with honey. It was that sort of a match. And it was that sort of, trust me, it was that sort of a match. Let me see, it's a little early for me to be thinking all that straightly. Yeah. The particular emphasis of the day prevailed. And let me say that part of the reason we're what we are is due to the fact that we isolated those things that we felt like needed correcting at the time. And here's the downside of that. The things that we saw that needed correcting, which probably did, were externals and rituals. The Lord's Supper, baptism, these all are valid things. You know, in the organization of the church, it needed cleaning. But I'm so sorry that this inevitable result, the Achilles heel of that, is that it is that that we emphasized, it is that that we held up as being what needed correcting, and then, by the way, it bit us on the heel because it became the thing that we became known for. And as a result, we got our identity from these externals and the forms. And you know, part of it, you couldn't avoid it. Couldn't avoid it. But we became elliptical again, and we became out of balance. But the thing that hurts us is that we became out of balance in terms of the things that are external and not the things that are eternal. I might ought to stop there because that may have struck a nerve. Any comments or observations? That's the sort of, that's what isolated us. That's what identified us. And you know what? That's what has done us in, really. And I don't know whether you want to comment on it or elaborate or whatever, but I've got so much else to, let's hold it. We're going to have a reply time at the end. But like every other restoration movement, we pitched our tents at the point where our first leaders fought and fell. And they didn't do it intentionally to exclude anything. I think our leaders felt that these other things were in place. The deity of Christ, all of these great themes. I think they felt like they were in place. Now it's time to move on to the next step and clean up the rest of this. But you know, the people didn't understand that we thought all of those things were in place and that we were trying to get just the rest of the fine-tuning done. They didn't understand that. Our own people didn't understand it. Now the leaders may have, but it didn't take but about one generation for the people who were following to catch from the leadership the emphasis that eventually led them into majoring in minors and minoring in majors. And so we've ended up with that as our personality and that as our identity. And we fail to realize that restoration is a process and it's not an accomplished fact. And here's something I'll throw in to kind of lighten the day. Calvin and Hobbes, don't you love them? It's true, Hobbes, ignorance is bliss. Once you know things, you start seeing problems everywhere. And once you see problems, you feel like you ought to try to fix them. And fixing problems always seems to require personal change. And change means doing things that aren't fun. And I say fooey to that. But if you're willfully stupid, you don't know any better, so you just keep on doing whatever you like. And here they go down this hill. The secret of happiness is short-term stupid self-interest. We're heading for that cliff. I don't want to know about it. Wah! I'm not sure I can stand so much bliss. Careful, we don't want to learn anything from this. Isn't that a rich one? That's what happens. We're in this process. Are you aware of the fact that a restoration movement is underway right now? And I don't, you know, here we are. Why are you here? Somebody said, because we're not all there. And that's a possibility, you know, that's possible. But what's happening, and it has to happen in every movement, there has to be a continuing reinvention, there has to be a continuing restoration, and we're a part of that. You're either part of the resistance to it, or you're part of the process itself, or the advocating of it. The process, I suppose, contains both of them, because I've never known a movement yet that could enjoy the process without the negative as well as the positive of being present. I want you to notice something. This is something that it's not profound, but it's something that'll, it's so pervasive that it'll slip by you. Note the presence of the twos and tension in Jesus' teaching. The twos and tension. The twos, the number two, intention. The two sons, a man had two sons, told one to go work and told the other to go work, and one, the response that they gave. There were two men that went up to pray. There was a man that had two sons, and the younger one went off. There were two people that came up to contribute. One was the poor widow, the other was the rich people. The two, whatever else. The two men that went up to pray, yeah. The two ways, the broad way and the narrow way, the two divisions in the judgment, the sheep and the goats, the twos, all these twos. So I say it's not any great revelation, but if you'll watch it, Jesus built his teaching around those twos. In fact, the whole of the revelation of God is built around the twos. The difference between evil and good, darkness and light, truth and error, all these. So it's not anything great, except I want to just spin off of that this morning. I learned that. I saw it in a book. I think it was this book on Finally Comes the Poet. And those of you who are preachers ought to look at that and get it. But I want us to spin off of that. Life and this desire to restore also thrusts us into a breach between these twos in tension. We are finding ourselves right now in America, in the scene, in the church. In every church that I have been acquainted with, there are two churches. in every congregation, there is a segment that is holding to, you know, to try to be conservative, and there is a segment that wants to be more liberated than that. We're standing, number one, we're standing in the breach between two periods in history. But in every church, there is this tension. Is there any church here that doesn't have this tension? I don't know what about Woodmont Hills. Are there people in it that are a bit uncomfortable where you're going? Do they know where you're going? Do you know where you're going? Rubel says, no. How can you know if he doesn't know? Hopefully the elders know. And you know what? I'll tell you this at the end, but a woman last Wednesday night just threw our whole small group meeting in such a wonderful tizzy. And she asked this question. She said, Brother Woodruff, this transition you're in, did you hit it over all at once, or did it happen over some years? Because she said, right, I'm feeling real uncomfortable, and I'm nervous about it. Well, we're in that point. And I tell you, I don't know how you can avoid it, and I don't know, but what it's essential. I think it's good, provided we know how to handle it. We're standing in a breach between two periods of history. Check me out and see if this is right. Number one, we're standing between one period when, for the most part, we were characterized by a church-centered message. A church-centered message. I'm going to show you some slides that will illustrate this. The reason why I'm showing you these slides is because this is an invitation to hear a soul-stirring series of gospel meetings, May 19 through 24, 7:30 p.m. each evening, the Granville Church. I took out the name of the town and the name of the preacher. But the reason why I'm showing it is for two reasons. For one, for those of you who are not aware that there was a period when the church was our message. It was the central focus of our message. And there's some of you here today who don't know that. You're not aware of it. I'm assuming that. But even if there's nobody here that's not aware of it, there are those of you who are here who lived at that time, and this may affirm the way that's where I feel comfortable. But probably you're here, and I want you to see just how far you have traveled from this position. You may not be aware of it. Now, this was what was put out, and you know, I started to redo the whole thing and put it out on computer and generate, and I thought, no, that's going to take care, it's going to destroy the real nature of it. It was a time when technology wasn't all that great, and we could just scribble something out and put it out. This is what was inside it, some things you ought to know. You should know that the New Testament times, the church is called the temple of God, the bride of Christ, etc., etc. You should know that the church was built on Christ. You should know that members of the church were called. You should know that the three permanent offices in the church are, and we're going to be looking at things probably 90% of which are true. You know, I'm not degrading these things, but what I'm trying to do is give us a perspective to see where we were coming from. Then we should know that Jesus Christ himself loved the church, bled for the church, established the church, etc. We should know that man did not purpose the church, didn't purchase the church. You should know that in New Testament times there was one family of God, one kingdom of Christ, one body, one bride, and one church of Christ. And that's capital C. I didn't write it over. We should know that in order to get into the church, you must, etc., believe in Christ, the five steps. He only has four. Forgive that. We can laugh at ourselves because I've preached this. You should know that baptism requires whatever that immersion, and then you should know by baptism sins are washed away. You should know that the faithful church must worship in spirit, must meet on the first day of the week, must sing, not play, must pray, must edify, must take, and then etc. Now, you should know that the same church today is in your community. It's not a denomination. It's still faithful to the New Testament patterns in all things. That's pretty bold. It is one in fact and teaching. That's an outright lie. Sure, we know that. That's not right. We've never been one. In fact, we've been one in theory. We wanted it, but we've never been one. Anyway, that's. But the point I'm making is, that was the emphasis, that was the perspective why I'm a member of the Church of Christ. And like I say, all of these things, except those claims of having accomplished and having been won and having restored all this perfectly, that's a lot of, I'm just sorry, I can't buy into that. But the things that he's stating are things that we've learned that we don't need to abandon. You don't have to abandon those things. We learned a whole bunch of things that were true. We need to organize them in order of priority and realize there are some things I'm not willing to take a bullet for. And there are some things that I don't think you're going to stand before God in the judgment and answer for. And we're going to have to grant each other slack. But the things, for the most part, that we've learned, they're good. Why I'm a member of the Church of Christ. Because God is the builder, Christ is the head. And he goes through all these things that we've heard all those years. And, you know, like I say, I don't question 90% of them because it is the Lord's, you know, he goes on and on. Because it prayed, and all this, it is the church. It. And it was the center of our preaching. I'm saying all that to just point out that we are standing in between that period when the church was the message and a period today when Christ is becoming the message. And it's, I don't think I need to emphasize that because I feel like that you're a part of it. You have been influenced by it. Rugel's message is Christ-centered. He's holding up Jesus Christ. You've been affected by it. You may not realize just how much you've been affected by it until you see something like what I just showed you. I think that's going to make us realize that, by the way, we aren't where we used to be. And we're just not there. The question is that facing us today, can these two live in tension? And can we then be better people because of it? Let me just make this a very simple statement. I believe this, and stop me if I'm not right. I believe that a church-centered message will produce pride, and that pride will eventually bring division. On the other hand, I believe that preaching a Christ-centered message will produce humility, and the humility will eventually bring unity. Now, is there any objection to that? Those two basic statements? And I believe that's so. I believe it's right. I believe it with all my heart. I'm willing to go before God in the day of judgment and stand up and he asked me, Jim, what did you preach and why? I'm willing to make that statement. I believe that Jesus Christ preaching him would produce humility, and that's the very basic attitude of the kingdom, and that humility would bring about the unity that we just so desperately need and that for which he prayed. Okay, now, those two things. But, you know, that in itself needs qualifying because the very preaching of Christ and the pleading for unity is in our own movement producing division. And it stands a good chance of those who are pleading for Christ to be the message and unity to be the result. It's very possible that those people can become proud that that's what they're preaching. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Satan doesn't care how he gets into you. He just soon come through the basement or the back door. He don't want to come through the front door. He won't even identify himself. He'll dress up like something else. He doesn't care how he destroys you. And if he can get you destroyed, if he can get you to be proud over the fact that you're not proud, he'll get you that way. And he, you know, he'll let you wear that button. Most humble man in the church. He don't care. Okay, this transition, another thing, this transition is producing two opposite emotions. We've already alluded to it. One emotion is that of fear and resistance in those raised on a church-centered message. There was a man I went to see the other day who became very disturbed because we were starting to serve the supper from the back instead of the front because of the various reasons. But that really wasn't the problem. It was just that was the straw that broke the camel's back, that there was so much. He was about 75 years old, and he was feeling this enormous movement and this shift. And I asked him, I went to see him, I said, tell me how you're feeling. I said, your generation is, they're feeling the brunt of this. How are you feeling? Listen to what he said. He said, I feel like that the foundations are just eroding out from under us. And he said, kind of like the saw eroding out from under a cliff. And I said, oh, I understand what you mean. I understand what you're saying. But I said, TJ, what are the foundations? What are the foundations? I said, when you hear me stand up and question the deity of Christ and question the authority of the scriptures and want to be out from under the control of God and the foundations will be eroding then. But the things that we many times have split over and are disturbed about, they aren't the foundations. They're the eroding, perhaps, of the things on the fringe as we come along into different times, but the foundations, that's not the foundation. But there is that type of fear. You remember back when Ezra recorded the response that the people gave to the rebuilding of the temple? There's an article in your packet that is an article on that, this generational shift that caused some of the people to the young people were so excited. Man, they were just going, whoo, go, isn't that great, and all this excitement. But the old people who had seen the old temple started crying. And this huge body of restored people who'd come out of Babylon and had come back to Jerusalem, they were there crying and also rejoicing. And it said you couldn't tell what was happening because the noise was so loud, you couldn't tell who was crying and you couldn't tell the difference. It was just one big, well, that's what's happening today. There's a lot of resistance, a lot of mourning, a lot of crying because people are feeling, oh, it's not like it used to be. And yet, you know, among the young people, and it's not totally generational, but to a great extent, this transition is generational. Thank God there's some old people saying, go for it. I've been waiting 50 years to hear this. There are older people like that. And there are some young people who are just very, you know, I think sometimes it's attitudinal almost across the board, but it is generational as well. But anyway, there's joy and release in those who are aware that Christ is the message. For it's from Christ that they get their identity. Here's the big issue. What do you get your identity from? If you get your identity from the church, you're going to be terribly upset at the thought of the church being in transition. But that'll come because you've gotten your identity from the church. If you get your identity from Christ, the church being in transition is not going to be any big deal. Because the church has always been in transition. There never has been a time when the church wasn't in some kind of transition. All the way through the New Testament, you see the church in transition. And they had a transition that was enormous. They made a shift that was absolutely phenomenal from a Jewish backwater type religion to one that included all the non-Jewish nations of the earth. And it brought in people who were uncircumcised, who were unkosher, and the transition that the church made against its will. They came to it kicking and screaming. Well, that was the church in transition, and we've got to recognize that. The church is always going to be in transition, but you don't get your identity from the church unless the church is your message. Okay, is there any observation or a comment or refutation of that you'd like to make? We're open. That's a very basic premise that I feel like we're standing in this time of transition between a period when the church was the message and now that when Christ is the message. And may I just offer this as an observation. I firmly believe that we're living in a time when there is a Christ-conscious wave that is sweeping over the whole United States, over the whole world. I believe that we're living in that time. Okay. He says that this idea of preaching Christ and preaching the church, that it's not an either-or, that it's the same thing. But that's almost like describing the bride and describing the groom and saying, well, no, you just add them together and divide by two. You don't really get an individual like that. If you want people to fall in love with the groom, you don't describe his bride. If you want them to fall in love with the groom, you're going to have to describe the groom. It isn't the one and the same thing. One is the result, the other is the cause. We have been a result-preaching people. We've majored in result material. Yes, which we have called preaching the gospel. We call that preaching the gospel. That's not preaching the gospel. It's preaching the truths that are true enough about the results that take place when you have Christ preached. But to go over here and preach that message of the church is a mistake that we've made of preaching results rather than causes. Now, this needs to be clarified because this is on tape and it's going to be heard by people who are not here to catch up on the spirit of what's happening, and it needs to be clarified. Are we standing in between these two periods where once the church was the message and where now Christ is the message? And can you preach Christ? Do you have to renounce all of these truths that we learned back here? No, you don't. And the question that Rubel is going to address and that I have here picked up on here at the end of my talk here, is it possible to be distinctive without being divisive? Can you hold on to who we are, things that we've learned, and yet not make that the message that we proclaim as our message? Now, here's part of the problem of our message. We have, in the past, had the wrong audience. Because we targeted the wrong audience, we designed the wrong message. We designed our message to meet the audience that we felt like needed addressing. Do you know who we made as our audience for years and years and years? Religious people that we felt needed fine-tuning. They kicked us out. Really, they kicked us out, and we pitched our tent right on their doorstep, and as they came by, we would give them our message to the religious people. We became a people who geared a message to the church people of America that dealt with their intellect rather than designing a message of the heart for the people who were unchurched. I think if we could have identified who our audience was, that they were the down, not the down and outs, but that they were sinners, that they were the people out there who didn't love God, they were the people out there who were the drunkards and the prostitutes, the people to whom Jesus came. He came to all sinners. He didn't come to any righteous people. If he could have found one, he would have come to him. He couldn't find any righteous people. But the point is that once we clarify who the audience is, our message it'll take a different shape. The reason why I know that's true, when we went to New Zealand, my audience changed. We hit New Zealand, a virtually an atheistic country. And I was over there preaching this that's on these charts that we handed that out. That was our first handout. The true church. I'm serious. Not that particular one, but it had all that information in there. We had a handout called The True Church. And we handed it out by the thousands. I hope nobody read it. Not that it wasn't true. I don't think they read it. There wasn't a scripture in it. There were about 500 scripture references, but no scriptures. Not a one was quoted. I thought they were just sitting over there waiting with their Bibles and concordances. You know, they were gonna check all this out. What a rude awakening. That's when we came to the conclusion we would not publish anything for the community that couldn't be read from the mailbox to the wastebasket. Yeah. Because that's about all they were going to give it. If you couldn't do it like that, they weren't going to get it. Now, are we clear? You think that's clear enough? We're standing in that period when the emphasis has switched. It's changing. I came back from New Zealand realizing that the message is not the church, it's Christ. It's Christ. The church is the result of preaching Christ. And let me just be so bold as to say, you don't get the church of Christ by preaching the church. You'll get a sect by preaching the church. You only get the church of Christ by preaching Christ. And so let's just leave it at that. We have become a people who look for simplicity, and we've ended up not being simple, we've ended up being simplistic in terms of everything being in a box, everything being clear-cut. We suspect theology that delves into anything higher or deeper or longer than can be expressed on five fingers. We've reduced repentance to what takes place on the third finger. Repentance doesn't take place on the third finger. Hear, believe, repent. It's a bit deeper than that. And I'm thankful we can laugh at ourselves. But now, these two different emphases produce two different results. A church-centered message pushes us ever deeper into details, minutiae, and to an assembly-oriented mentality where ritual and form are the weightier matters, and in which the assembly becomes the litmus test for faithfulness. Answer me this question. Is Joe a faithful Christian? Well, certainly he's present every time the doors are open. enough said. It's the litmus test for Christian faithfulness in terms of orthodoxy, what's done or not done inside the four walls in the assembly before or after the dismissal prayer often determines orthodoxy. And I'm sorry that that's true, but it's true. And this is proven in our movement to bring only death. A Christ-centered message draws us ever deeper and deeper into broader the arena of life in which relationships are the primary concern. The litmus test for a Christian faithfulness is love. By this shall all men know that you're my disciples, that you love each other. Unity, that they may be one, that the world may know that and believe that thou hast sent me. Kingdom concerns become righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Spirit, Romans 14 and 17. These are the different results that come. And it's, you know, I don't have time. In fact, our time is up. I've frittered away our time. But let me just ten. Oh, okay, right, great. Oh, I thought I was through. There are two objections. There are two objections that I've got to mention. A Christ-centered message, someone says, makes denominational lines become blurred. And I know that. I realize that. But is this not why our movement began in the first place? Did we not begin by saying what we want to be is just simply Christians? Not Christians only, but only Christians. And for all practical purposes, it caused, or the desire was to cause, the breakdown of denominationalism, the breakdown of sectarianism, so that we could all be one. That's the purpose. Are we now going to renounce the very thing that gave impetus and gave direction to the movement when it began? I don't think so. And yet I think we're going to have to come to this, we're going to have to come to grips with it, that a Christ-centered message makes denominational lines become blurred. And the second observation or objection is, quote, when denominational lines blur, conviction wanes and growth declines. Are you aware of that downside of this, if it's a downside? If it is, that is a downside. Are you aware of the fact that when sectarian distinctiveness becomes less and less important, that the movement begins to just drift away and the numbers decline? Are you aware of the sad fact that the more sectarian a group is, the faster they grow? Are you aware of that in the past? I can't say what's the scene for the future, but in the past, it is a known fact that can be documented that the ones who are the most absolutely convicted and the most absolutely sectarian in the sense that it's either this way or no way at all, they're the ones that grow. So when we talk about backing off of that and getting a Christ-centered message where denominational lines begin to blur, we're faced with the prospect, they say, those who would be critics, to say, yes, and as soon as that happens, the movement will stop growing and you'll start just simply being a non-existent group. You'll die. And let me just simply say, that is not a reflection on the Christ-centered message. It is a reflection on the fact that we live in such a sectarian-oriented society that if you were to remove sectarian zeal from all the churches and all the America, would there be enough of anything left worth telling to blow the hat off your head? And I'm just asking us, if we were to take away what we have been doing for the last 100 years, our major emphasis has been directed toward people who were already religious. They already believed in God. They already believed in Christ. They already believed in the church. They already believed in going to Sunday school. They already believed in tithing. Back off of that one. Let's go. Yeah. See, we've directed our message to those people. If you were to take that away from our thrust into the world, if you were to take that away from our momentum and all, what I'm going to call sectarian evangelism, where we take a person who's already at that point and then fine-tune him and transfer him to our movement. If you were to take that away, I want to ask you a question point blank. Do you, not anybody else, but do you have anything left that's worth taking a bullet for? Do you have anything left that's worth telling somebody about that you can't hold it in? If you don't, then this other objection will be true. You'll just simply evaporate. But if Jesus of Nazareth, that Emmanuel, number one son of the earth, if he is our heart throb and our soul and our life and our breath and our consuming passion, if he is that, then God be praised when we preach him. There's enough lost people in the world that don't know God from their neighbor's cat. There are enough people looking for life. They'll know it when they see it. And they'll be attracted to him. And whether they even know that they got it from us, I don't care. All I want them to know is that Jesus of Nazareth, really, he's the embodiment of God. And that when we've met him, we've met God. That's our message. And when you get a people who are attracted to that, there won't be any decline. There'll only be an exhilaration that will absolutely capture you. You know, I don't believe in totally committed churches. I'm sorry, I don't believe it. Don't believe they exist. I do believe in the possibility of there being in existence totally captured people. There's a big difference between being totally committed and totally captured. Totally committed puts the focus on you. You ain't got the guts to be totally committed. I don't. And you ain't no better than I am. Something's going to get me. I've known it for years. And I've decided it's going to be Jesus Christ. I want him to get me. And if he can get us to where we can't get away from him, then, that's where it's at. Well, okay, these two objections I thought though needed to be addressed. The Christ-centered message makes the denominational lines become blurred. That's what we started off wanting to happen. And yet, all of a sudden, we've become the very thing we resisted. And now we're resisting the very thing we originally decided we wanted to be. Let's don't switch and, you know, let's don't do that. Let's decide if it was a noble aspiration to want there to be a non-denominational, biblical-based people who were standing for Jesus Christ and all human creeds were being wiped away, then let's not hang on to ours. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. Amen. And let's not be an impediment to the very thing that we intended to bring about. Let's not stand in the way of that original desire. Okay, two questions. Which way did Jesus lean? I'm telling people today, you know, if you can't figure out where Jesus stood, see if you can figure out which way he was leaning. Because you can spend your life maybe, because there's some things about him that they're not all that clear. Well, don't be arguing about it. Just figure out which way he's leaning and just determine that's the way I'm going to lean. And when I get in the judgment, I know him well enough to know when I say, Lord, I couldn't figure this one out, but I saw you lean in that direction. I decided that's the way I'm going to lean. You'll be okay. You'll be okay, but let me just give you one verse. Look at Mark 9, 38 through 41. This is one of the most troublesome passages, and I've never heard it preached on until just recently. We always preached on the other one. He that's not with us is against us. And he said that. You know, he made the statement, whoever's not with me is against me, and he that doesn't gather with me scatters. Man, we preached that until we're just worn it out almost. But here's one that's stated the other direction. Jesus had just spanked them for arguing among themselves as to who was the greatest. They were bickering about who was going to be the greatest. And Jesus just simply, if anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all. And he took a child and put it in their midst. Verse 36, taking him in his arms, he said, whoever receives one such child, etc. Well, after John got spanked for arguing about who among them was going to be personally greater, he kind of recovered and then came back and said, well, we found a man over there casting out demons in your name, and we put a stop to that because he didn't follow with us. And Jesus said, good boy, John, we don't want to let this thing get out of control. No, Jesus said, oh, don't forbid him. Don't stop him. No one who does a mighty work in my name will be able soon after to speak evil of me. For he that's not against us is for us. And then he reduces it down to this simple design. Listen to this common denominator. Deal with it as you will. I tell you the truth. Whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you bear the name of Christ, he'll not lose his reward by any means. That's too simple. He's got rewards for people it seems like we're just friends of Christians.
He's not an enemy, he's an ally.
If he's not an enemy, he's an ally. And you know what? He's still, the us and them is still there. But he just says, hey, don't stop him. That's the way he was leaning. If he's not an enemy, he's an ally. If he's not against us, he's for us. He emphasized relationships over ritual. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Oh my, the only commission he gave us was to preach him. You realize there's not a commission in the entire words of Christ that commission us to preach the church? Not one word did he commission us to preach the church to the whole world. He said, preach the good news. And the good news that he had reference to was his life and his death and his burial and his resurrection. And that we can be a part of it if we want to be. What's your responsibility in all this? It comes down to that. What is my responsibility? Your responsibility is the same responsibility that every other generation of Christians has. And that is to put the church that you have inherited up against the standard. Put it up against the standard and trim off all the excess that has accumulated over the years. Now that's a pretty simple statement. But I learned this from Rubel's book, and I don't know why I hadn't seen it. It's guess what or who is the standard. The first century church isn't the standard. Christ is the standard. The first century church was just an imperfect effort to implement the standard, to conform to the standard. Imperfect? Why, certainly. Where do you think all the New Testament letters came from? They were written to imperfect people trying to implement the standard, or trying to mimic or be the standard, or to become like the standard. But they didn't make it. And so all these letters had to be written to these churches who were the imperfect replica of that first standard. Christ is the standard. Your task is to put the church that you've inherited up against the standard and just trim off the excess that has accumulated. And that's not anything peculiar to you. Every generation has to do that, because every generation accumulates these barnacles. Take the ship out of the water, scrape off the barnacles, try not to take any of the wood with it, just get rid of the barnacles and put it back in the water and go on about your business. It really kind of becomes really simple when you get it down to what the message is. But we're standing in between those two periods. When a church-centered message was once the real message, that was what was preached for the most part, and the Christ-centered message now, and we're feeling some emotional effects. There are some responses, there are some results that take place, and there are some objections. But like I told one man who a part of a very, very conservative church in Bryan, Texas, he called me and he said, Brother Woodruff, can you come to my home? And I said, yes. It was shortly after their preacher refused to eat a hamburger with me. I invited him to come eat a hamburger with me. And he said, I can't do that. But anyway, he called me and he said, if I stay where I am, I'm going to die. I cannot live spiritually staying where I am. But he said, when I look to where you are, it scares me to death. Well, I laughed, and he laughed. We both laughed together. I said, look, it scares me. I said, if it were not for one basic fact, I said, I have intentionally, irrevocably determined to sink my anchor as deep as I can into Jesus Christ and keep my anchor rope just as tight as I possibly can. And I said, where that leads me, I don't have any question about it. But you know, my conviction of that isn't going to be sufficient for you. You'll have to come to that conclusion yourself. Rubel's conviction of that is not sufficient for you. And him verbalizing it on Sundays and whenever he preaches to you, that's not adequate. It won't do for you. Have we got a deal for you? He needs about 100 helpers. These books that we've brought here, I don't know, what did you say the value of them is? $66. But they don't want to take any of them home. They don't want to box any of them up. You really There are only 50 of the copies, so that's going to mean only about half of you are going to get one. What he's recommending and I'm recommending is that you each one get you a set of those. Take one of each one of them. You've already bought one of mine. I'll give you your money back. You get your money back. Yeah. No, you. There are three of my books that were bought, so I'm going to give the money back. Now, here's the deal. Either put $40 bill in the box. Put $40 or a check or an IOU. If you don't have the money, put an IOU in there. But get you a set of these books and take them home with you and read them over the next 3 or 4 months. Read one a month. That'll be about every six. That'll get you through June or May. And then just the IOU ones, if you put in an IOU, just put $5 a week in there for the next 6 months. You know, that'll take care of it. Don't add that up. Five times six is 30. You know, that's a bargain. Do that, but here's what you need to do. Get you a partner. $40. Get you a partner, though, because there aren't enough but for one between each two. Get you a partner, and you all be a buddy to each other and say, when you get through with that one, I want it, and I'll swap with you. So that brings it down to $20 apiece. Now, look, how many of you have spent $20 on a meal for you and your wife the last 6 months? Well, sure. Then, for the sake of your own spiritual leadership in your home and in this church, come get you in between, or go get you a copy of it, get you a partner, put in $40, or put in an IOU, and then drop a $5 bill in the plate every week for the next 6 months, and you've got it. Do that, would you? Because this weekend is going to be a flash in the pan. Unless you will take these books represent a broad spectrum of what we've been talking about. Bob's book is a excellent. Rubel has recommended. I haven't read it, but it's one of these historical kind of reviews of who we are. My book reflects the progress or the process that's in place. Rubel's book on the second incarnation, the discovering of our roots, the core gospel. All of these books will help deepen the impression upon you. You're not going to get much if you just get what happens here this weekend. It'll be a flash in the pan like other retreats are, and then it'll kind of wane. But if you'll take these, go home, read them. Read. And then this will have some long-lasting effects. This church is a flagship. I'm sorry that if you don't like that, I'm sorry. But it's a flagship. You're charting a course for a lot of people, but it needs to be broader based than Rubel. It cannot be resting upon his shoulders. He's got to have about 100 men standing beside him saying, we believe that's exactly the direction we need to be going. Will you do that? Okay. Now, we're going to take a break. We're 5 seconds over. Man, I've never done that in my life. Let's break, and then we'll come back at 15 after.